Welcome to Sketchy. My number is 14.
I'm Mr. B.
Today we're going to be talking about three topics that are just blowing up, and that's kind of our style now. Whoa, what did the Washington Cubes, is that what they were called?
The Chicago Cubes.
Yeah, the Chicago Cubs have won a World Series, something that hasn't happened in 108 years, and that's apparently news because everybody else wants to ignore many of the more serious things, which is the upcoming election, our second topic of the show, and all the things surrounding the FBI, Clinton emails, and this whole Trump-Russian connection. So we're going to touch a little bit on that. And lastly, we're going to be talking about Val Kilmer and how he apparently doesn't have throat cancer, even though he believes in something called Christian Science, which is pretty fucked up. So we're going to talk about what is Christian Science, who started it, and what's up with Val Kilmer. Is he crazy? The answer is yes. But first, what are you drinking? Well, I'm drinking, as usual, our Russian friend's corporate beer, Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Something tells me you're probably sponsored by them in a sort of shady back alleyway like Trump.
No. See, for me, I believe that sponsorship happens by first enticing a sponsor. And I'm like, hey, Russia.
So you're open to
like your
basically
beer.
Any deal to throw at you.
Well,
At this point?
Hey, we're called Sketchy, for God's sakes. I mean, it's not like we're making false promises here. You know
what
I mean?
Have no illusions, folks.
No,
we are for sale.
You know, the whole point of Sketchy, I'm going to tell you, is to make you trust nothing. Okay? Even, especially not us. But if you go around sourcing things that you think you know what you're doing, you are making me sad, Internet. You make me so sad with your fucking lack of knowledge.
So you kind of lead a sort of bohemian non-corporate life.
Sure.
In general. So maybe you're trying to drink in through what you lack in your day job, which is corporate big influence. Whereas me, on the other hand, I'm drinking a homebrew from our pal, Mr. C.
Yeah.
C. Doge. And
same thing as show number one, which is what you
kind of a role
also.
Reversal, because I kind of lead the corporate style life.
Yeah, sure.
Day anyway, so I try to drink the bohemian malt of the gods.
Oh yeah, he's super corporate too. He has like people call him sir and shit. Probably make salute you. You probably make them salute you, crazy psycho.
Well, I don't make them, but I don't stop them.
Oh snap! All right, let's talk first about
this World Series business.
Because
so the
it kind of exploded on the interwebs, and everybody, even people who don't give a shit about baseball, couldn't help but have an opinion. Because just that.
What is this basic ball? And tell me more about this World Cup.
You know, it's funny. That's actually what he thought it was called, World Cup.
My lack of popular culture is profound.
Stunning.
No, something to behold.
It's tremendous.
Is what it is.
It's tremendous. Oh, that word.
I think we're going to have a reversal of meaning. I hope we do, of the word tremendous and all the other Trumpisms. You
no,
know,
we'll call them
you know,
Trumpendous.
Like back in the day, the word awesome meant,
sure.
You know, it invoked fear and it was a
oh,
bad
yeah,
thing.
Oh, that's true.
Like
that's true.
The hells would open up and the flames would shoot out
like
of
like you
your
wouldn't
eyeballs.
Want to be in awe.
No, you wouldn't want to be
thing.
In awe.
It's
but now
thing.
Awesome is like just slightly better than cool.
You can basically blame California 80s culture for that one, I guess.
Yeah. Burning out everything.
Well, think about all the words
meaning.
That they made popular back then. Radical. I mean, first of all, when
gnarly.
You used to say radical, you'd be like, oh my God, a radical. I mean, we still use that now.
Tubular.
Yeah. Radical Islam. You think like, oh man, that's gnarly. Yeah. It is gnarly in the old sense. You know? Awesome in the old sense. Like bad. Please don't awe me. Because, you know, back in the day when God used to do his whole awe thing, you would die. You would turn into a pillar of salt. Okay? Or you would burst into flames. Or once, when Moses saw the shoulder and deltoid of God, he passed out. Just the shoulder and deltoids. That's how beautiful they were. Anyways, let's talk back to the Cubs here. Because
the Chicago Cubes.
Apparently baseball is important when something that happens very rarely happens.
Did you hear that recording of Chicago, like, after the however many centuries of drought they had?
Well, one.
One.
One
that's,
century.
That's a lot.
It is a lot for a sport that is not that old.
Did you hear the city
more
fucking
older
light
than
up?
The century.
That was insane.
Yeah, that was a bit crazy.
It sounds like a war zone. There are literally explosions going off.
Yes. Explosions of color, though, to be fair.
Insane.
Although that shot of Chicago reminds you that there's some where the parts where the buildings are is flat as shit.
No wonder it's so fucking windy, man. Plant a couple trees, God.
Yes.
Hello.
Hey, now's the time, Chicago.
Chicago, man.
Maybe they don't grow well in Chicago. The wind. They just get pushed down when it gets real windy or something. But anyways, the Windy City now can boast a trophy that looks like it's, I don't know, the UN wrapped in a weird crown. Have you ever seen that thing? Type it in. Put it in. It's like a bunch of weird flag things. It's one of the ugliest trophies, in my opinion, of all sports. To be fair, baseball is an older sport, so, you know, I guess you gotta just live with all the bad traditions that just happen or something. But
weird.
It just doesn't look good.
It doesn't look structurally sound.
No, it looks cheap as shit.
It looks pointy and annoying.
Doesn't it look like if you moved it around, like the flag parts was kind of waved like a bobblehead?
You know that those flags snap off all the fucking time.
And plus, are you, like, would it be disgraceful to put it on your head? Because it looks like a crown of a fool.
Well, you know the winning team probably took it out. Who are they? The Cubes? They probably took it out to party and snapped a bunch of little gold flags.
One of the interesting things about it, it reminds you that at this moment in time, I believe that Bill Murray could walk into a bank and take a bag of money, and the bank would just be like, "Oh, Bill," and they wouldn't stop him.
Stop! I want a selfie!
No one has stopped Bill Murray from doing anything. He went to the White House, and he just started giving a press conference about the Cubs.
That's insanely great.
And then he just basically snuck in when the Cubs won. Walked in and he stole the microphone from the Fox News guys that had come in there, and he just started interviewing people. Because Bill Murray can now do whatever the fuck he wants.
He is legitimately the most powerful man
on the
planet.
He's been given like a Mark Twain Award for just existing.
You know? Right. But you know, he's been at it for a long time. There are ancient internet archival videos of him showing up at college parties and doing karaoke and all that jazz.
He does whatever he wants.
Stepping behind the bar, not knowing what he's doing, pouring random drinks.
Do you not understand what he's doing? So when Bill Murray is dead and in 200 fucking years, he will be the Aesop of that future, because he will have filled so many lives with stories where everybody's going to have their fucking Bill Murray story.
Every family has a Bill Murray connection in some way.
If you're
way.
American, and if you're in the Northwest, Jesus Christ, especially if you're in New York. So the point is
Bill Murray stamped my passport.
He figured out how to leave an imprint greater than the gods. And so, more power to Bill Murray. If you just want to walk around, fuck with people all day,
I had a near-death experience.
Legend.
I flew to the light, and at the end was Bill Murray. He said I had to live, so I turned around.
This is why I think that if we actually get to some sort of Armageddon-like situation where there's such global tension.
We're like 8 days away or 6 days away.
Just shut up. Just don't be this dour. Anyways, imagine you have this horrible conflict and you're like, who will solve it? And you're like, Bill Murray walks in and he's like, hey guys,
hey,
everybody calm down and have a drink. And then it's like an 80s party and then everything is okay. Maybe.
Hawaiian shirts for everybody.
Of course.
Bill Murray.
Now that, I mean, we don't have much to say about the fact that the sport is really kind of dying. I think that the entire structure of how baseball works is kind of sickening. I mean, you have people making these ridiculous salaries. And meanwhile, like, there's not more people watching this thing. I mean, right now there was a lot of interest, but yeah, next year everybody's going to forget. And let's deal with the fact that also that the team that they were fighting, remember that whole team and its controversy about, hey, your mascot's racist as shit. Oh, yeah, well, what if they would have won, eh? You would have splashed that fucking logo all over the place. Reminded you of like, oh, yeah, they're mistreating natives somewhere in the U.S. right now. Isn't that weird? Baseball.
Well, at least their racism is systemic, right? That's the new excuse.
Well, that's the new buzzword.
It's systemic. Don't worry. I'm not to blame. It's systemic.
I don't actually even think that most people really know what that word means.
They really don't. It doesn't abnegate any responsibility for any of the players. It just means that everyone's in it together.
Yes.
It'll take a coordinated action amongst every participant to to solve that problem, but it doesn't mean they're, you know, free of any
Well, there's also something actually that blame. I find to be inherently suspicious about the view that most of our problems are inherently systemic, because it takes
it negates
the fact that one, problems are often much more complex than one thing, one catch all for all. So that's that first suspicion there. Okay, but
the
beyond
fact
that,
it's not one person's fault doesn't necessarily imply it's everyone's fault.
No, but beyond
fault,
that too,
and therefore unsolvable. Basically.
No, but beyond that too, what that indicates is that by that very statement, you're saying, well, the system itself, or whatever other parts of it are, it's almost like giving up on it. Because what is much more likely is that there are very large and malignant parts of a corrupt system. But to suddenly say that the entirety of that system is what's causing the problem is basically to throw your hands and say, well, I'll just tear it down, bitches.
It's not my problem. Talk to the fucking system.
Well, it's also, you know, we live in a culture now where it's so easy to kind of try to boil everything down to just a kind of goo that you're like, this is the truth. I've boiled every human element to this goo, and this goo is all truth. And you're like, no, man, you've basically created this such a broad term that it's basically meaningless.
Yeah, and you know, soon when you're writing your thesis, you're gonna have to boil it down to 140 characters. That's where we're headed.
Thesis? Okay, so here's
Of research boiled down to a tweet.
This is a bit of a tangent, but you may have seen this video TLDR. That popped around about this class I believe it was the University of Johannesburg. I'm not quite sure. But they were having a discussion about how to decolonize science.
Oh, boy. And decolonize mathematics.
And the one thing that you kind
of... I don't think they realize there's a different kind of truth being a falsifiable,
actually,
empirical
no,
truth.
But what they don't realize is they've already kind of done so.
Well,
because,
philosophically sound
no,
true.
No. They've done so because the actual... the percentage that you need to pass a grade in these universities is about 30%. So, of course, you've completely decolonized science. You've taken all the parts that perhaps are part of the Western heritage of science, and you've definitely gotten rid of a passing grade.
I would say
that idea is
that
gone.
Hardly as, like, it's easy to misconstrue what that means, because you have, you know, theorems in mathematics that are provable in a very, very rigorous and strict way that's completely devoid of any humanity. But decolonizing science by lowering the passing mark because of cultural problems, I would argue that's more of a social science move. It has nothing to do with the truth value of the science itself. I would say so, it's decolonizing academics,
right? Sure.
Or scholarity or something.
Absolutely.
But,
I mean, they're legacies, no doubt, of the colonies, but they.
But
unfortunately,
it's not decolonizing science.
What you're doing is you're taking any of the good elements out because you feel as though every part of it has this, you know, like I said, it's like this view that everything is systemic. Oh, well, certainly you've got to throw the baby out with the bathwater. That's how you solve a problem. I see. What a very interesting attitude that humanity has now towards problems.
Right.
Ignore the truth.
Hey.
Just double down on your truth. And
Pythagoras was an asshole. Let's question everything.
First of all, Pythagoras was a murderer and an asshole, but it doesn't mean that he was wrong.
And very likely a cult.
It was a cult.
And, you know, he wasn't a singular guy.
Do you know why he was a murderer?
I don't know.
Because if you tried to divulge any secrets, they would fucking murder you.
Right.
That's a
mystery. It was a murderous cult.
Yes.
Actually, you know what? We should decolonize that shit and rename the theorem. But even if you do so, I would argue you're not really decolonizing mathematics. You're not changing the fundamentals. If you relabel, like if you're used to doing calculus with one little symbol and the professor swaps out the exam with a different symbol, it doesn't make it new mathematics.
No, certainly doesn't.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Come on. Come on now.
And why reject a structure if it's just there? You can improve on it more easily than reject the whole thing. And this is why I say again, if you think that the problem with something is systemic, you're willing to throw the whole fucking baby with the bathwater thing. I mean, that's... Why are we ignoring this really simple but kind of disgusting analogy? You know what I mean? Like, hello, the whole point of it is to say, this is ridiculous.
Look,
but we don't feel like it's ridiculous.
I'll just say that I'm all for humanity becoming enlightened again. and becoming enlightened in a way we never have before. And part of that is casting away old stupid narratives and prejudices sure. about other races and other cultures and how, you know, different genders aren't as smart or as capable. I'm all for
oh,
that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But I think there's a real risk that if we don't try to be precise in what we're doing, if we don't try to improve the veracity of our thinking, if we sort of combine tweet culture and tweet thinking with something as fundamental as reinventing all of culture, we're going to do it wrong.
Oh,
and
yeah,
we're going to
so
cut corners.
So
we're going to make mistakes and we're going to regret it. We're going to forget how to launch rockets. We're going to forget how to do surgery. We're going to forget how to play the violin. Like, this is how bad I think it could get.
Yeah. You're not wrong. I mean, there are many examples of times where the collapse of a society is not so much in that there was, like, a famine. Famines happen and societies survive. What happens is really there's a loss of confidence and faith in the general idea of society that you've built. And once that starts, then it's very hard to get it back.
There's an intellectual laziness that comes over the society. There's a sort of riding on your laurels happens for generations. And then all of a sudden, no one's an entrepreneur. No one's an adventurer. No one's going to take a risk.
Nice beer, though.
Hey, if anybody's looking for a sponsor, I have a hell of a radio voice.
I hope this doesn't get flagged for copyright violation, because that is a signature Pabst Blue ribbon opening sound.
You know, that cool, crisp, really non-threatening taste is the kind of drink that I can get behind. Non-threatening. Literally the least threatening of all cheap beers. Pabst Blue Ribbon. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just, you know what I drink it? It is the cheapest beer. I am not a rich man. And although if I was, I know what I'd probably be going for. I'd be going for that Mexican shit I always drink. Yeah, them Coronas. That's what I really like.
Well, you know, there is a cheaper beer. At least in our city. And
sure.
So even you have standards. There's a beer that's made in our own city.
It's undrinkable. It's disgusting. It's offensive. It's offensive to my tastes. You know what I mean?
So what you're saying is you've upgraded to Pabst Blue Ribbon.
No, I haven't upgraded. What I like about Pabst Blue Ribbon is how inoffensive it is.
It's important to know your level of rock bottom, because it can only either stay the same
or get
better.
This is the rock bottom of I don't want any flavor that interferes with the general mixture of what I already have in my mouth.
You know what I mean? Pabst Blue Ribbon pairs swimmingly with my halitosis.
Yeah, it pairs swimmingly with my weed mouth, okay? It doesn't sort of try to hop that shit up, which is what you're drinking, okay? I mean, like, or just having too much body. Right now, if I had body, all I'd be thinking about is the body of it. And you know what? I just want to relax, get a little buzzed, and just keep doing my show, man. Keep doing my show.
So let's wrap up this World Cup, Chicago Cube. What do you think it means for America? Do you think it's really the distraction everyone was looking for?
I actually
and
think
of course
it's,
something nice for Chicago.
It's probably the worst thing that could have happened in this election, honestly.
Because it takes the eye off what's really happening over at the freaking FBI.
No, what it does is that it makes people believe in miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're gonna be like, Trump might be that miracle. Idiots.
Less
that they
than
are.
Once in 100 years. It's a miracle. No, it's statistics.
And
bozo.
Plus, you have to realize that most of the people that are voting for him are extremely religious, and it might be kind of like a sign for them. You know?
I think, from the vantage point of a bored Canadian, America seems like the reality show to beat all reality shows.
Well, it has...
It's entertaining, but it's also gravely
serious.
So
you understand that there are many parallels with the Reagan kind of elections, right? What did Reagan and Trump have in common?
Well, they were playing the simple common man card. They're going for someone you'd like to...
Nope. Okay, let's start at the beginning, because I just realized you know nothing of the history of Reagan. So
they roped in the evangelicals.
So Reagan...
They were outsiders.
No,
they were not career politicians.
Okay, well, now you're finally starting to say... Okay, but the most
important
thing...
Tell me what you're dying to say.
The most important thing is that... So Ronald Reagan's claim to fame, and the most important moment happened when he read a book called Witness, Okay? And Witness was a book by a guy who claimed that he was working for the Communist Party and that he had uncovered like this grand conspiracy, essentially, and that he had sort of like rejected or whatever. And he wrote this fantastic book with almost no facts, by the way. And when Reagan read that book,
facts.
He's like,
boring,
basically. But he, you know, there was a lot of talk of religion and so on and so forth. But when Reagan read that book, but previously Reagan had been a Democrat. And, you know, he'd be basically fairly blue. But he read that and all of a sudden he's like, oh, my God, the Reds. I got to fight the Reds. Okay. And he's convinced that this is like almost like a kind of holy mission, if you want.
So did
his
he,
part.
I don't know if the book revealed this, but did he feel like to fight the Reds, he couldn't do it as a blue?
Well, it's just that he became...
We're talking Reds,
the book
Russians,
itself,
right?
The book itself was written by someone who was pretty significant in the conservative movement. I'm trying to remember his name. Anyways, that book itself created, or the zeitgeist of conservatism, because it made everybody fear the communists, who until then had been responsible for most of the improvements in terms of labor laws in America and so on and so forth, even more than the Socialist Party. But this was kind of like a new... I don't know, a kind of con smear job that had effectively gotten Nixon elected in something called the Pumpkin Papers, where they had accused the guy, the lawyer who basically created the UN of being a communist spy, because this fucking asshole wrote the book, accused him of it. Because he had previously worked as this fucking migrant worker and stayed at his house, and he knew secret information about this guy. And then he used that to pretend that he was a secret communist. He destroyed the career of one of the most important and honorable men in fucking history. And then Richard Nixon participated in that and created his career off that shit. So that's why he created the right movement. This was like such a major event. A goddamn atomic bomb that changed politics in America, dude.
Okay, this guy, Whitaker Chambers.
Whitaker Chambers.
He sounds like a chap we'll probably have to do a little more research on
him
and dive in, because just from scanning his wiki cover page, he was an American writer, editor, and former Soviet spy.
Yeah, that's what I told you.
His allegiance was listed as Soviet Union and United States, and... active 1932-1938 as a spy, 1922-1959 as a writer/poet, and 1926-1939 as a translator. A perfectly vanilla, plain old career.
Sure.
And died of a heart attack. Not bloody likely. Anyway.
No.
We should do a dive
into
that.
We'll do a dive in.
Whitaker Chambers.
Regardless, in that, like I said... He read that book, and it influenced him so much that he's, not only did he switch political parties, but he made it his mission now to kind of, like, become president. And it really worked. And the thing was, here's an actor, man. Here's, like, basically, who would he be compared to? Think high B-movie leading man. You know what I mean?
Like one of the Baldwins, perhaps.
Yeah. Alec Baldwin reads... some book.
Or the...
switches... yeah, it's basically...
Bruno Baldwin.
No. Actually, Alec Baldwin would probably be pretty close, because by then...
You like presidential
When Reagan was younger, he had a few choice careers, but then his career went a little bit down, and he was like playing more westerns and stuff, which was kind of like, romantic comedy stuff of the 90s. Anyways, regardless, so they switch party affiliation, but more importantly, they're kind of... pop culture phenomenons, you know what I mean? Like, in the same sense that the Donald Trump's major, his Trump card, if you will, really was the TV show The Apprentice. I mean, they dared give this fucking show Emmys. The man has Emmys.
Right.
Okay?
That's
yowzer.
It's a bit much.
Yowzer. And so all of a sudden you have somebody who's commanded quite a bit of media attention from... a very dumb demographic. I mean, you watch The Apprentice, and I mean, that's not a great sign. You know what I mean? Like, if I had to choose somebody to like date, and they told me that they watched that show like regularly and that they liked it, I would be, we got a problem.
Like, what's always amazing to me is how many hours per day people spend watching TV. And there's not a lot of free time because Americans work really hard.
Sure.
And, you know, Canadians do too. But I think Americans work more hours.
Sure, of course they
technically,
do.
And they take less vacation.
They work the second most hard of any country. The only country that works harder is Japan. And they kill themselves at work.
Yeah.
And they're hardcore. Well,
food's better, though. I'm just saying. So, like, they're working for probably and commuting to work in horrid traffic for, let's say, 9 or 10 hours a day. The remainder, maybe an hour, is spent eating, and sometimes that eating hour is spent in front of the TV, and then they pass out. That's no way to live. That's no way to become self-informed. That's no way to, you know, reflect on life and make it better. It's insane. Like, that sort of, if you want to change the world, you have to change people's TV viewing habits first. And sure, it's slowly being replaced by internet viewing, crappy little 8-second Vine videos or whatever, 6-second Vine videos. But that's a big point of friction. How do you get over that?
Well,
it's not,
you know,
like people are watching documentaries, okay? They're watching The Apprentice.
Okay, that's fine. But, you know, there's a lot of documentaries that anybody would watch because they're so fucking gorgeous and beautiful, and you sat their fucking fat asses in front of the screen, and they'd still watch it.
Oh, that's fine.
That is not the problem.
That's fine.
The
real problem... It's the gluttony of excessive
TV.
No,
I don't even think it's that. Look, like, you're to ask me, if you suddenly said that the solution would be to show everybody great quality television, well, I got fucking news
for you. I'm saying less television.
No, but even...
More active, like, reading or writing or something.
Right. How the
playing
fuck
sports.
Are you going to convince someone?
I don't know.
To do that shit.
I don't know.
Yeah, this is why...
I think the whole situation is intractable.
Okay, but this
people
is,
watch so much
But this
TV.
Is why I want to tell people to stop fucking living in fantasy land, okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The first thing that you have to accept
exactly
is that what is humanity? Well, humanity is what you see. And if now you're going to be like, well, we can change these elements of
we
humanity.
Eat, we breed, we
you're
watch
like,
TV.
No. Okay, what you need to do and what we always do about the things that we dislike about ourselves is that we mitigate them. So an example is that there's actually an interesting time in history where we became more civilized. And you can actually measure this. You can actually tell the date and time. It was the publishing of a very specific book on manners.
Well,
and when
you
this
could
book
argue
fucking
that we,
came out...
We became more civilized when we invented agriculture and stuff,
just,
right?
Just... Try to listen for 5 seconds. You might learn something. So what I'm trying to say is that there was a book on manners that was written. I'm trying to remember what the name of it is.
Oh, yeah.
Etiquette book. Yes, when this etiquette book came out, this is, and literally I think this is how you change manners. You change them in the most minute ways. You change manners. What we lack now, ladies and gentlemen, on a major scale, are some new fucking manners. The manners... of the new age. You know what I mean? Like, just a good example is whenever my fucking dad uses Skype, it drives me insane. Like, where they'll just start calling out of the blue because they think it functions like a phone. And it don't. All right? You know what a good manner is? It's like sending a note before a call. That's a fucking polite way to go about it. We need the world's next generation of fucking manners. And when we teach everybody manners, all of the really big raging thing that you have in your mind, like, why are people so mean? Why they're assholes? Because we forget about the little things. We need the new manners of the world so that we all calm the fuck down, chill out, and we don't tap into that monkey side that makes us all assholes. That's why manners are so important. That's why dressing in clothing and making sure you don't smell like shit is so important in society, because it turns out that if you do, you become violent and crazy, okay? Smell nice and society is nicer. Hey, where can we take this shit? Well, don't try to change society in the big ways. Change it in the little goddamn ways.
But aren't the little, you know, being courteous to each other, the little gestures more symbolic of something deeper? Like, just a general respect for ourselves and other people.
I don't think
it
is.
Or do you think having manners and knowing that you're supposed to not smell bad, knowing that you're supposed to address people in a certain way...
It's a pressure.
Do you think it sort of grooms people over time to be respectful?
Yeah, otherwise it's like it's not that they wouldn't. It's like the broken window syndrome, where once you're used to a particularly low level of life... You fucking think that's the new norm, and you can't. Because you can't
slide. Low character sort of attracts low character.
Yeah, you can't let yourself slide. You gotta be high class all the time. And the high class has to force the low class to class it the fuck up a little.
Take a shower, you low class bum.
But you know, I'm not the spokesperson for high class. I'll be the first person to say I'm not the guy to write the manual. I'm the guy that you give the fucking manual to. You know, I'm the guy that's out of control here. I'm the one who needs the fucking manners and the smelling nice and the fucking perfume and shit. Right? But so do like 100 million other assholes right now.
Right.
They needs them manners. And they needs them good.
So there's Amy Vanderbilt, Complete Book
yes,
of Etiquette.
Thank
and
you.
There's also Emily Post's Etiquette
Ooh.
Book. But anywho.
And what date is this book?
They're in the 50s.
Yeah. Okay. So remember when everybody's like, oh, I wish we went back to those days. I think it's just because when you had a little bit more etiquette, everybody's memory of it is slightly better. Like if you just had a decade where we just tried to say, listen, you can have an argument with people or whatever, right? But if at the beginning you had to be so annoyingly polite to each other, you wouldn't even dare go to the depths of hell that you do now because
yeah.
you would have already built up all this great fucking, you know, friendship from all the nice things you were forced to say in the beginning.
But you know what I would say? I sort of get what you're saying. Like, you have to build these mannerisms, good
mm-hmm.
manners.
Absolutely.
Over time, and then eventually you can grow into them and everybody treats each other well. And it's for everyone's benefit. But I don't think it's guaranteed in all cases. I think that you can have people that are politically correct or overtly seem nice, but they're really two-faced assholes. You know, like you can have the facade of being polite
sure.
and just be a horrible person and be completely disrespectful.
Okay, no, but see,
so I don't think it's guaranteed. I don't deny that there's.
Can I boil it down a little bit further though?
It can be like training wheels.
Yeah, but
and
listen
you become,
to me.
You know,
you haven't boiled it down enough because here's what I'm saying. I'm saying that if we even started at the very fucking basic, I mean, even the problem when you're engaging someone might be annoying. Okay? Like, when I started to discuss, when I see the people discussing with one another, the first thing that I notice is that every single person that's discussing things online has immediately taken a combative attitude towards one another. It's almost like you can't help it. Your attitude online is having an argument is usually, in maybe even your mind, it was like, I'll be the devil's advocate here. I'm just going to go on being the devil's advocate. Classic example of like, okay, in the whole example of let's be more not civil, but more polite, should you write this? I'd like a person to
yeah.
ask themselves that question first. And you know what? I'm not stopping anyone, but it's like if there was a rule saying to interject in a conversation that does not involve you in order for you to discuss a point at which you're thinking is the height of rudeness.
Yeah, yeah.
So that at least you know you were rude. So that you, if you do something rude, you are aware of it. Because I think that for the most part, a person who just interjects their fucking useless opinion in a conversation doesn't realize they're rude because there isn't a standard etiquette that this is some fucking rude shit.
Well, you know, I think this alone is a huge topic, the idea of anonymity online and what kind of behavior that breeds. And I heard an interesting viewpoint the other day. It was someone who was... I think they're on the radio or podcast. They're just saying, you know, it's not like being anonymous is the holy grail. In fact, when people are completely anonymous and they can just go onto any old freaking, you know, website chat room or whatever and post whatever they want, then it's just fertile ground for this kind of behavior where people sort of snipe each other and get in, say something stupid and get out. Say something hurtful, not listen to anybody's viewpoints. So it becomes a cesspool. We've all been in these cesspools of comment misery. So their viewpoint was it's important for people to be able to be anonymous so they can, you know, challenge governments they don't like or protect their own safety or adopt different personas. But it might be more like our viewpoint isn't as sophisticated as it needs to be, and eventually we'll get to the point where we understand there's a place for being totally anonymous. We also understand there's a place for being pseudonymous, in other words, having an alternate name.
Which most of us have.
But it's persistent, so you have a certain reputation
of course.
That you want to maintain.
Of course.
And then, you know, there's your real identity. And I don't think forcing internet, you know, users to scan their driver's license to get online is
good Lord.
No, it's ridiculous.
That's horrible.
There are very few situations online where you want your real, true legal identity to be out there. Maybe when you're renewing your driver's license or perhaps in the future voting online. Maybe that's the right place for that. But being able to, you know, as a society, tell the difference between having a reputation and having a sort of a permanent identity online that isn't necessarily tied to your physical identity, for just for your own safety, and maybe having multiple identities. That's where it's at. Yeah. We need to stop pretending things are black and white.
Okay, but see, here's the thing. What you don't understand is that the pseudo identity will actually overtake most people's real identity in probably about 15 to 20 years.
Oh, I don't doubt it online. It's kind of like the idea...
No. Shut up about online. There's going to be no distinction. In 15 fucking years, your online life... It's like saying, oh, I'm going to use dial-up. No, dude. In 15 years, you are going to have such a complex second life online that you will... This whole identity thing that you're talking about... I mean, it's so important that I have received, as a supervisor at my job, emails from people who have had arguments with former employees that are trying to get them fired.
That is ridiculous.
The conflict of your online life and your real life are about to become very fucking real, my friend. And in 15 years, what do you think that evolution is going to be? Where now that's tied into all this other virtualized environment that you're spending so much of your goddamn free time in, and that you're... That people are expressing themselves, and entire families, Tom, are putting their lives online, and they're probably going to create virtual reality shows of themselves. It's going to be some weird, sick shit, but it's going to be horrible.
You know what? You're right. People are already, you know, changing their Facebook names to be some sort of subtle tweak on their real name, or they're using their middle names.
They don't want to be themselves.
Because they just don't want their real, actual name to be out there.
They don't like
themselves.
And I get
that. And Facebook took a very strong stance a couple of years ago. But they've backed off. There was the whole transgender identity. There was the safety. There was... like, oh, I'm known as a DJ or something, and this is my
or they're like, if you do this, I'll go elsewhere.
Right, exactly. So that's fine. But what's, I think, significant here is at an infrastructure level, society has been preparing this for quite a few years. Like, when you're online with IP version 6 instead of IP version 4, it's a little bit technical, but basically in IP version 4, you have a unique home address. It's like your street address or your phone number. Everybody can identify you through it. Maybe you would have a second private one and one public one, but it wouldn't go further than that. In IPv6, you can have as many addresses as you want. It's built into the protocol. Every single website you go to, every single computer you're interacting with can know you as a different address. The address space is so huge that you can generate a random one every single...
Yeah. You could have one for life different, and it would never be the same.
Number two, Bitcoin and the whole idea of a distributed ledger, which is being picked up by the big banks. They're not necessarily going to adopt Bitcoin, but they're going to adopt this idea of transactions with a ledger that's distributed amongst everybody who's ever done a transaction. Do you think they're putting real names and real company IDs in that database? Hell no. They're putting a unique ID that's just, if you look at it as a human, it looks like a random string of characters. But every transaction can, again, have a unique ID for the sender and the receiver that they can just burn and use a different one on the next transaction. So it is traceable in a way. You can verify where the money went, but you don't necessarily have the ability to trace it back to an individual. Number three, Apple Watch, Apple Pay, and similar technologies, which also big banks are getting behind. Every transaction you make, every store clerk that you pay with your phone or your watch doesn't know your real credit card number. They get something else. They get like a sort of a token that is only valid for that transaction. Your bank verifies it. They send the money. When everybody gets the okay, you're golden. But they never know your real name. They never know your real identity. So we're going to see this over and over again.
It is the digital version of money. Because money, when you give a dollar bill and you take it, you know that I gave you it. It was tender that you could recognize, but you don't know who I am from the dollar bill. It's the same idea.
It's sort of the same idea. Yeah, exactly. It's
a completely transferable form of value.
Having much more fine-grained control over how anonymous we want to be in every single aspect of our lives. And it could be that, a new type of identity will emerge that will supersede our legal one. You won't show your driver's license to get into a bar. You'll show your other identity. Right? That's the age has been verified, but the name is secret. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And same for comments online. You want to be able to earn like karma points. If you use the Reddit example, you want that sometimes. Or sometimes you want to be purely atrocious, like the 4chan identity. We're going to have more options.
Well, it's what's going to really happen, though, is the merging of your digital identity with yourself, or at least probably more likely the exclusion of your real physical self and the focus on your digital one, is that for the most part, people always feel that they can... You can build that identity. See, for the most part,
right,
when your
right.
physical identity is the product of things that are not under your control, even how you behave or feel or think. But if you create a well-crafted digital one, you can make sure that that digital one is only ever cute, only ever happy. You know what I mean? Like, you're transferring a lot of what you wish you could be as an individual, and you're not having to deal with its consequences. Your real one has. So... What I'm saying is that we're going to create a virtual fantasy land where we're going to be these imaginary versions of ourselves. And why would anyone in their right minds be convinced that they to not go there and have and just hang around? Like, this is the problem. Like, we're basically creating our own hell. You know what I mean? By basically making this virtualized heaven. So... that is what brings us down, man. Like, nobody wants to leave this little pleasure sphere that we're going to fucking build for ourselves where you could be who you want to be in a virtual world. Like, of course you're going to do it. Good God. In real world, you're probably a fucking struggling person who has panic attacks about where the next fucking check's coming from. But in the virtualized world, you could be a magical princess that can fly and wield a magical sword and who everybody praises. Gee, who do you want to be today?
Yeah, like your body's hooked up to VR and rotting.
Yeah.
Full of cockroaches everywhere.
Basically.
And your virtual world is living the life of a
prince.
Oh,
what a
life. Of a prince.
Yeah. You're losing focus as that body's slowly deteriorating. But what a time.
Right.
What a time. So it's just basically the equivalent of creating digital crack cocaine. This is what we're
a digital crocodile.
Digital crocodile. Yeah. And... is there any way to stop it? I'm not that imaginative. I can't do it. I certainly can't fucking do it.
Well, the only way is to... awareness is the first step.
Is
let's
it
say
now?
That. It is.
So
it is.
Sick of that fucking statement. We are aware of everything now.
No, like...
we've all taken that first step.
We are aware, perhaps, of that one thing, but not everybody is. And more importantly, if we're watching TV 9 hours a day, we're not really reflecting on the most important questions, are we? No, we're not. Which brings us to some other topics.
I guess we're going to talk about...
where do you want to go with this? Val Kilmer and the ignorance religion?
No, we'll end with that.
Or the FBI
Let's,
and the election
I wanted to, you know what? We'll speak briefly on it because I'm not as knowledgeable on that as I wish to be. And no one can be because the details are sketchy. But what you will notice is that you'll notice that both news outlets will focus on different things. The liberal news outlets focus on the fact that the FBI has... definitively decided that they don't want to talk about Russia and possible allegations of grooming on Donald Trump because they feel that that would kind of influence the election, which is true. However, it didn't seem to stop them from deciding that releasing a letter saying, well, we're looking at these Clinton emails, which in that sentence sounds really salacious and crazy, and there's no way of knowing if there's any information there because, again, this is an FBI investigation.
And, you know, the wife of the porno texter.
Yes.
Wiener.
Yeah.
Aptly named Wiener.
So it's a very strong...
come
guilt,
on now.
It's a very strong guilt by association kind of a thing. But...
it seems like pretty serious.
But now what? You're like, well, it's fair game to suddenly release this Russian stuff now. Is that how it is? Because apparently if you read anything concerning the FBI, it has torn everyone apart like the election has. So if you really want to know what the election is... it is the perfect example of the most divided time that America has been politically since literally the Civil War.
Right. It's culture versus purpose. Culture versus country.
Oh, no. It's the old versus the new generation. But here's the reason why it makes this entire thing so scary.
Oh, it's also South versus North or Red versus Blue.
Well, it's actually not
so
young South, but yeah,
there are young Republicans and there are young Democrats. You know, there are old Democrats, too.
Yes, I suppose you could...
but I get what
painted
you're saying.
That way, but
it's
like
divided.
America is like 11 nations, I think they said. Anyways, it's not this unified group.
Culture clash.
It's just that it turns out that the one unifying thing that you can always count on, perhaps it's the only anti-war phrase that you can yell, is if you yell USA, USA a few times, it seems to get everyone to chant the same thing for a little while. And then maybe if things get a little crazy with each other, that's your defense mechanism. To remind yourselves that you're all supposed to be one group.
Wow.
Because that seems to be one of those things that's just not connecting. Now, the major issues that are going to come up from all of this, by the way, is that it's going to make the race much closer, and it also means that on election day, what you're going to witness is some of the things that you were most afraid of, which is probably armed people at polling stations, violent eruptions, claims of rigging, and then regardless of the winner, a very difficult transition. And if it is Trump the winner, remember that they have to institute his mandate. If they really have only 4 years, which is probably only how long a Trump presidency can last, honestly, because there's, I don't think that they can actually do anything that would positively influence their economy. But the things that they've said they're going to do is they're going to pull out of NATO.
Nice. So needs it?
Basically saying, hey, Russia, man, you want that sort of like land that you had back in the old days? You can have it. It's all good. That's the first thing. And the next thing is that they're really going to have to start planning for the deportation of 12 million people. And that means that they're going to have to start real fast because it's going to take many years to do such a highly ambitious and almost
seemingly impossible. Like that would take too much work and probably just dragging it out and leading to more like internal, like drumming up the internal strife of the country. And
sure,
and anger,
it would
stay in power.
If they did such a thing,
which is horrible,
it would completely divide. It would be the closest, like a Donald Trump presidency is the closest thing that you can actually imagine to a sort of like internal civil war, because everything that he's decided to plan to do, especially the deportation of all the illegals, forces everybody to kind of like take that.
Yeah,
you can't sit back and do nothing at that point because there's so many people. That's 12 million people.
12 million people, and they're not white. And
actually, some of them are. Because the interesting thing is that the majority of these people are not the kind of like jump over the border people. They're actually people whose visas have expired. So
many of them are
professionals in organizations,
yeah.
And these are still people with money.
But it's strange how comfortable everybody on the Trump camp is with just racism. Just abject, white supremacist, good old days racism.
Well,
very
this is,
comfortable
this,
with that.
This is also
but,
where
but not
you
comfortable
see the divide
with,
between...
Not comfortable with, like, a weird email server, right? Like, sure, okay. You can hate an email server.
No, but here's the funny thing. They're like, well, you're compromising national security. And you're like, well, Trump compromised national security with the Russians. Okay, we're cool with that.
Many times.
And you're like, well, who else do you fear but the fucking Russians? Like,
right. Hello.
You know, figure that one out. So you're kind of like, but leave it to the fact that, again, these are religious people that believe that a man who has had four wives, who cannot name more than three books of the Bible, I believe he would be the first atheist president ever. Like, there's
right.
No way this man believes that there's a God that's above him. Like, there's no way that's true. There's
how could he
no way.
Pray to God when he is God?
And the funny thing is that actually Americans don't know how to deal with him. Keith Olbermann, who's usually, I kind of like him, all he can do to Trump tweets now is to say, fuck you. Like, it's literally that low of a dialogue where I'm like, don't you even know how to socket to someone anymore?
Right. It's just short-circuiting the entire American psyche right now, this whole election.
No, actually...
Tuesday is going to be quite the day.
What they don't understand...
I think we'll have to have a little party.
We will have a party. But what people don't understand, and this is probably the same thing that made everybody underestimate the whole Brexit thing, which is why it makes Trump a much more likely candidate than Hillary Clinton, is that everyone forgot the bravado and the intensity and the urgency of... not wanting something, right?
Yep, it's true.
So the question is, do people not want Hillary more or Trump more? And when you see how the left is about itself, you're like, no. There's no way that their hate and their fear is nowhere as near to the fear and the hatred of their enemies.
The degree to which the left wants Hillary is far less than the degree to which the
correct
the right hate Hillary.
And so yeah. And so you know, you could say, well, that the factor of even the right that dislike Trump
hate
will be great enough to offset
motivator.
That. And I'm like, I don't believe that. I even believe that it, perhaps in their heart they keep hoping that maybe it'll be okay. And I don't want to create too much family strife by voting against what my family members think, which is always the problem of any electoral system that relies on two candidates. Congratulations, America. I think you finally really understood what was the problem with your system to begin with, was really the lack of choice. And I'm sure you can jokingly say that your liberal or libertarian candidate or your Jill Steins or viable candidates, but I'm like, can you name their running mates?
Nope.
That's a problem. Like, even they themselves, like, why wouldn't even the two people who compete against each other debate each other? Why wouldn't they do that? Right?
That's not a bad idea.
Why couldn't they even try to organize that, of showing that, hey, at least we're trying to have a debate with each other too? They couldn't even hope to do that together, because they're not really on opposition. They're more like kind of personality parties that you kind of like, they're on such extremes that you're always catching those people who are like, we're going to change the world. You know, those types of people.
I guess we'll have to do a play-by-play as we approach the election here.
I suppose, but...
I think there's going to be more FBI stuff that's going to come out, and wouldn't it be crazy if, no matter who wins, they're both, like, being sued 80 million times and probably going to be indicted?
I think what's interesting, though, is that the one thing that... the funny thing about the whole Clinton Foundation stuff, that they want to paint it in a bad light, the problem is what... It's very easy to do... if you ignore every other charitable foundation that does exactly the same thing. To indict the Clinton Foundation, you'd have to indict every single charity, which I think you should do. But that's not really the purpose here. The Clinton Foundation is basically exploiting what charitable organizations do. They utilize our sense of charity to basically cripple third world economies by effectively destroying any hope of them building their own systems.
Right.
It's the new form of economic terrorism, really, charity. like, Haiti has 10,000 charitable organizations.
That's not normal.
Yeah, that's not normal. And meanwhile, they still need more charity? No, I think that these guys who... By the way, if you work for a charitable organization, you don't pay taxes and you get all these benefits.
How about for every 100 charities, you need one new law to keep them in check? How about that?
How about actually we rethink this whole charity business? Why does charity exist? Because of the flaws in your system. Well, okay.
Right.
Maybe there's something else that we can do rather than charity. It's interesting that the Jews actually had their own theory of how you do charity. They believe that you let poor people, and this was actually a law, you have to let poor people take the sort of like the dregs during harvest. Or that every 50 years you had to sort of renew property rights.
Mm-hmm.
So that you couldn't have a landlord that would just monopolize everything. And by the way, nobody celebrates the year Jubilee. Who in their right minds would sign a 50-year fucking lease to a mortgage? Nobody. You can't even fucking pay it off. The year Jubilee does not exist.
Slaves and prisoners would be freed. Debts would be forgiven. And the mercies of God would be particularly manifest.
Oh, well, they're missing the most important part of the year Jubilee. And trust me, as the man who rewrote the Bible, that's not really the part of the year of the fucking Jubilee. Okay?
It's apparently Judaism and Christianity.
So...
But in any event.
In any event, think I know what I'm talking about. But the point is, like, this was an interesting idea. I don't think that we've really explored the idea of how do we deal with extreme poverty very much. No offense to the world. Okay, charities aren't doing it. Sorry. The world is still fucked. But let's just move on.
Dang.
I don't want to talk about this depressing fact that the world's going to end. Let's keep moving.
Val Kilmer.
So if you were living under a rock and you don't like pop culture like Mr. B here, basically you would have known that Michael Douglas a little while ago talked about how Val Kilmer had the same kind of cancer that he did, because he basically a year ago gave him oncologist? Is it? Would you deal with cancer?
Yeah.
Anyways, so he gave that information to Val Kilmer. Now, if you were to read the news 1 year ago, you would have read that Val Kilmer's family was very concerned with his health because of his faith, and that he wasn't dealing with it. Now, it appears as though there was some surgery done. Val Kilmer denies that it was any kind of cancerous tumor. He just claims that it was malignant. But after about a year and a half, he still has a swollen tongue, and he hasn't come out in the public, nor has he sought additional medical treatment, and he doesn't talk about this ailment. He just claims that he's still recovering. So here's the thing. If you read his note and his response, he said, hey, I haven't talked to Michael Douglas in a while, which is fair. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Michael Douglas hasn't talked to people who know Val Kilmer. Know what I mean? But in any case, given the fact that even though Val Kilmer's like, oh, I don't got nothing. I mean, a year ago, family members are concerned. All right? Swollen tongue years after a surgery? I don't think so, pal. Yeah. I mean, I think we have a pretty good idea of how long secondary effects of surgery, especially on benign tumors, should be. And they don't really point to that thing. And here's the bigger thing. As a Christian Scientist, their major theology revolves around the idea that your mind and prayer can cure all diseases.
Right.
And, you know, this leads me to the whole point of, like, Christian Science, which is one of those things where in the 18th century, in 1875, in fact, was a fucking magical year for religions. Let me tell you what. Okay, here's what you had. Joseph Smith was just getting started with Mormonism, okay, around New England. Then you had the Millerites that were sort of coming. So this guy called George Miller basically said that he had found a calculation in the Bible that told him when the end was coming. And then he developed a huge following over the next 3 years. So that started then. And then that eventually led to the Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah Witnesses, all that shit. And then you also had the Oneida family. This was a weird group that believed in group marriages and shit, and they needed to make money, so they started making cutlery. And next thing you know, they kind of get bored of the fucking group sex thing, and then they just start making spoons. So, you know that spoon you have in your house that says Oneida? Yeah.
Right.
Weird religious cult that made it. And this big one here that basically became Christian Science is the only religion in North America that was started by a woman. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, girls can start some fucking crazy shit too. Congratulations, ladies. You're just as responsible as us men
of
brainwashing people.
Christian Science is founded by a woman?
It was founded by a woman. Her name was Mary Baker Eddy. And she is one of the 100 most important women in American history, actually. Mark Twain wrote quite provingly of her, in fact. He said that since Cleopatra, basically, there hadn't been a woman who could hold her fucking own, because this woman would open a new church like every 4 fucking days, man. All right? This was not some sit-at-home woman. This was a fucking powerhouse, dude. Like, by the time she had died, at least for a while, it was a very short while, but she had the fastest-growing religion, and she even fought, like, she was 90 and she was fighting to keep her independence, and, like, she had to go to court and stuff like that. Like, we're talking iron will, all right? So Mary's a kind of interesting woman because she not only did she teach herself to read because her father felt that she
had to
be...
How does one do that?
So, yeah, I don't even know. But her father was basically like, I don't want you going to school and being learned. You got too much will. He could not cut her down, okay? So good on this girl. I guess she got her father's sort of like strong willpower. But her father was a Calvinist. And you got to understand something about Calvinists if you don't know religion, is that they believe in something called predestination. And predestination basically means that God's already decided who's going to go to hell and who's not. So you're fucked, okay? Because it's mostly not everybody. So these were kind of like really harsh people. They're like, God will punish you. And if you read the fucking Bible, then you've seen plenty of fucking wrathful God that you can kind of cling to if you need that shit. So, sure, her father was like, the whole world is going to burn kind of thing, which literally traumatized this little girl who still had an iron will, and I guess like her own life made her have like this kind of chronic fucking illness all the time. Have you ever met these people? You know, you have a friend, the chronic ill friend who never gets fucking well and is always right. sick.
Like the hypochondriac or the guy yeah. who's actually sick?
No. Well, there's a lot of reason to believe that some of it may have been hypochondria. It's hard to tell, right? Like, you got to remember that in the 19th century, medicine was more dangerous than nothing. Okay?
Right. Risky.
They were prescribing cyanide. You know? Have a little cyanide, buddy.
Your humors are out of whack, sir. We need to drain some.
Heroin was developed as medicine to prevent addiction in patients who you were using painkillers.
Supplant addiction. Hello. Hello.
So you get an idea. And it turns out that she tried, you know, like any desperate person that has chronic illness, tried a variety of ways to heal herself. And she even tried, like, you know, mesmerism and things like that, you know, back in the day. Whatever was fucking hot, quote-unquote science. But, of course, it was bad science. So she thought that if you used prayer and just, like, you know, prayed to God that you would get better. And she wrote a book called Health and Science, and which is, you know, had nothing about science and very little about health, but very, like, a lot of things about scripture. And basically in it, she kind of developed her own form of Christianity, which had this idea that the whole world is an illusion, okay? The material world is a manifestation of the God mind, which you are part of, and that your ability to kind of manipulate God mind things are give you, you know, healing powers and, you know, I mean, I'm not talking like Matrix level fucking powers here, but that generally speaking, both the power of prayer and your own mental will and your understanding of the scriptures can fucking cure you of anything. And because her followers, it started to develop pretty fast, didn't go to a doctor when they were sick and these doctors weren't bloodletting them and giving them fucking cyanide shit, they got better than all the fucking people who went to doctors.
Right.
So that kind of bolstered their little claims for a little while.
It's called the new medicine bias.
Is that what it was called?
No. No? But it's okay. A great name for it.
That is a good name for it. But in any case, like, think about this religion that all of a sudden says, we took Christianity, we made it scientific, and their spiritualism had a lot in common with Hinduism. In fact, her book had apparently some passages of the Bhagavad Gita, or is that what it's called, in it, because of that whole, you know, like the idea that reality is an illusion and that kind of stuff. So imagine you had, I don't know, Christians who just thought that you could use mental powers to heal yourself. And over the years, Christian Science has kind of developed they've changed their views a little to stop being sued and stop having their adherents go to jail for letting their kids die. They've changed it over the years. Like, do you want to know the most famous kid to ever die of Christian Science was? It was Einstein's grandson.
Oh no, this old guy. Lesser Einstein.
Yeah, Hans Albert Einstein was a Christian fucking scientist, bro.
What?
Yeah, he had two of his three kids died in young, because they wouldn't go to the doctors and shit. There's literally only one Einstein that fucking made it, because the second son of Einstein, by the way, he just died in a mental institution. Yeah, and the daughter that he had, I don't know, they gave her away. She probably died a spinster or something. We don't even know. There's been no evidence of any.
Terrible.
There are
terrible.
Very few Einsteins in the world now, because you had to have a dumb son who thought Christian Science is all right. Tisk.
That's not right.
Tisk. Tisk. And now Val Kilmer is going to let himself die, probably, because he's like, I don't got no tumor. Really? Why is your tongue still swollen? You know, I was reading about tongue cancer, and it turns out that is one of the symptoms of a particular type of tongue cancer, because that's what he has, and that's why he called Michael Douglas, who had a tongue cancer, not throat cancer expert. So, Mr. Fucking Swollen Tongue, you need to go to the doctors, buddy.
He said he had a UCLA team clear him.
Yes, and part of that UCLA team was one of his Christian scientist advisors. So more than likely what they did was they probably had an advice session with a surgeon who told them that if they had surgery is about 70% of all cancer treatment, okay? there's, you know, nothing heals like surgical steel is what they always say. But the remainder has to come from radiation and chemotherapy to make sure that you get the rest. If you don't get that, then you only get the 70%, and the odds of you having a remission are very high.
Right.
So that's just that reality of surgery and cancer and then problems, though. Right? It's more likely to even come back, because when you have, when you do biopsies or surgery, you're kind of disrupting the cells over there. You can break them up and stuff, and cancer cells are really fucking nasty, right? They take weird shapes and shit. So sometimes even the surgery can come with its own risk. That's why they usually try to take a large section. But if they do that for things like tongue cancer, it can severely affect what you look like, bro. You need your tongue. So they try to be on the conservative side. So I'm not a medical expert. Okay, but I mean, I have read, the best that I can say is I've read several books about doctors who've often had to treat people who use faith healing and other things. So what my experience in terms of that is that I know what the sounds of someone who's convincing themselves that they've figured it all out is like.
The dissonance, the rationalization.
Especially seeing how in his own message where he denied Michael Douglas's claim, he specifically mentioned his religion, Christian Science. Which tells me immediately something about his own idea of how he needs to heal from this. Because otherwise he would have just said, I went to the UCLA, we removed a tumor, a malignant or benign tumor, everything is fine. No, he said, you know, he mentioned Christian Science in his message. So, yeah. I mean, I don't want to put my tinfoil hat on people, but yeah, I can usually read people pretty well, especially those that are deluded in their beliefs about medical science. And I'm afraid that Val Kilmer's probably pretty deluded. Pretty fucking deluded. But you know what? So is your hero, Steve Jobs, buddy. He was pretty deluded, mister. I'm going to fucking take some vitamin mixes.
Eat apples until I'm...
That's just dumb.
Eat apples and take no showers, I think, was his regimen for a while.
No, not the take no showers.
I think, for quite a period of
his
life.
Who said that was the thing?
It was a thing for a while, a fruitarian, I think it was in the bio.
Why do they think that taking no showers is going to make cancer go away?
Because, no, it's like you eat fruits and then you don't have to take showers. Because you're all in harmony with, you know, the fruitarian
So what you're saying is that, true, because here's the thing. If you start developing late onset diabetes, the runoff of your sweat can actually taste sweet.
Right. Maybe that's what they were mistaken with. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, you can have diabetes. And in fact, if you were overweight and you get diabetes, you're going to lose weight.
Yep.
Sure.
Yep.
Sure. In fact, when they first discovered diabetes, one of the things that they tried to do, because it was the child killer. So if you were born with juvenile diabetes, your maximum lifespan was maybe 9 or 10 years old. And you would eat all day, and you would wither away. It was called the starvation disease. Nobody understood what the fuck it was until they started to, like, basically, give diabetes to dogs. That's a more tragic story I don't really want to get into. That's a bummer, yeah? How they discovered the cure for diabetes. If you love dogs, you won't like that show.
Yeah,
it's a depressing show. But anyways, okay, so that leads us, that concludes the
we'll be back in a few days with this whole election madness.
You have any questions about, you know, like this crazy Christian Science there before we go?
Leave it in the comments down below. Hey, guys.
I think it is kind of fascinating that it was one of America's most important women, and that part of her religious movement was also tied in with that same tide of abolitionism slash... suffrage, kind of like
anti-suffrage,
prohibition, that movement that kind of like was all part of one thing.
It was an exciting time.
It was an exciting time.
Which wave of feminism was that?
That was definitely first wave.
Okay. Yeah.
Definitely first wave. Trust me, they only wanted upper class white women to vote. That was first wave. But we all have humble beginnings, everybody. All right, well, with that, I guess we're going to catch everybody after the horrible decision that all Americans need to make and the world consequences that will come from that. I guess we'll all have to deal that with next week.
Keep watching that TV, folks.
Yeah. And pray, I guess. All right, with that.
Pray.
My number is 14.
I'm Mr. B.
It's been a sketchy day, everybody.